From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This Veterans Day marks 100 years since the end of World War I. The war to end all wars, as it was called, transformed the United States, and that was also true for African Americans. David Davis is professor of English at Mercer University and has written and studied the role of Black Americans in the Great War and its effect on their lives. And he's joining me now from GPB in Macon. David, welcome.
Hi, Virginia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's such an interesting subject that I think a lot of people don't necessarily know about. So let's get into it. The U.S. declared war against Germany in April of 1917. So remind us of what it was like being an African-American in the South at that time.
It was difficult. It's 20 years after the Plessy v. Ferguson decision. The United States is heavily segregated. Woodrow Wilson is president of the United States. Wilson's a native of the South. And one of his first acts as president was to also segregate the federal government. So this was a time of Jim Crow. And when America declares war, African Americans are very ambivalent about America joining a war in Europe. On one hand, it doesn't seem to have any direct effect on African Americans. But for some African American leaders, the possibility of engaging in a war for democracy on a foreign shore would present an opportunity to make a case for democracy and equality in the United States.
So the war was meant to make the world safe for democracy. And as you mentioned, some African American leaders, like civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, urged African Americans to enlist. Other prominent Black leaders share in Du Bois' message, and did people buy it?
There was a good bit of back and forth on the issue. Some leaders believed that African Americans had no business being involved in a white man's war. Others, however, saw this as an opportunity to make a case for equality. Du Bois at the time was editor of the NAACP magazine, The Crisis, and he, along with the head of the NAACP, Joel Spingarn, worked with the War Department to make the possibility for certain concessions that would make it possible for African Americans to serve in combat roles in the military. And as part of his support, W.B. Du Bois wrote a very influential editorial in The Crisis in which he urged African Americans to forget their long-going grievances and stand shoulder by shoulder with their fellow white Americans in this war effort. He asked them to, in his words, close ranks.
Well, the federal government called for 100% Americanism in the effort, instituted a draft. How did the, let's say, racist politicians in the South and the soldiers feel about standing shoulder to shoulder with men of color?
Southern political leaders were very concerned about the possibility of African Americans serving in combat. Senator Vardaman of Mississippi, in fact, was one of only about half a dozen senators who voted against the U.S. declaration of war. And he voted against it because he was afraid that African Americans in uniform trained to shoot and kill white people was a much greater threat to the United States than the Germans. Mm. So this was a very complicated issue. However, America does join the war effort, and the U.S. government calls for a total war effort. And it certainly means that African Americans are going to be involved in the war. So the War Department has a difficult time discerning exactly how to use African Americans. And within a couple of months, they come up with a policy. Effectively, Jim Crow fights World War I. There's a plan for a draft that will involve both white and African Americans, but African Americans are going to be drafted into a segregated corps, and the majority of African Americans who serve in World War I work in labor battalions, a unit called the Services of Supply. About 350,000 African Americans serve in the war, and of that number, about 300,000 serve in these labor battalions. These labor battalions are extremely important to the U.S. war effort. The United States is mounting an international war across an ocean on very short notice. So all of the essential work of building camps, loading and unloading ships, building trenches and war materiel, all of that is the credit of African Americans who are serving in labor battalions during the war.
Did African American soldiers see actual combat in addition to those service positions?
They did. There were two divisions of African American soldiers who served in combat during World War I. And they provide a very interesting contrast in the African American war experience. One of these battalions is, one of these divisions is the 92nd, and they serve under American command during the war, and their leadership consistently derails their service in combat. And so their experience is not so glorious. But there's another division, the 93rd, that serves under French command during the war. And they serve with great valor and recognition. They hold their line for a record 191 days. There are no casualties. There are no prisoners. There are no surrenders. And many members of the 93rd were awarded the French Award for Valor, the Croix de Guerre.
What kind of record, beyond that recognition, do we have of the experience of life of an African-American soldier serving in France or overseas?
There are a few stories of African Americans who served in World War I, and as an English professor, I'm naturally drawn to the literary representation of the war. One of these soldiers is Victor Daley. Victor Daley is originally from New York City. He attends Cornell University. And when the war breaks out, he is among a small number of African Americans who is trained as an officer at the segregated officer training camp at Fort Des Moines, Iowa. He serves in the war as a member of the 92nd, serves with valor, is awarded the Croix de Guerre. And after the war, he's inspired by his experience to write a story of the war. So he publishes a novel called Not Only War that describes the experience of an African-American soldier from the South who enlists and serves. And the book is really a contrast about the experience of black soldiers in the United States in France. When this soldier is in the United States South, his life is segregated. He begins a relationship with an African-American woman who is also in a relationship with a white man, which delineates the role of Jim Crow even in romantic relationships. Then he's shipped to France, and in France, he's billeted in the home of a white French woman, and he finds that the relationships between African-American men and white women in France are considered differently than the relationships in the United States. So the book makes a really transgressive case for interracial relationships and transatlantic racial relations in the context of wartime.
You edited a reprint of that book by Victor Daley. How many people who were contemporary readers might have seen something like this, seen his account of what it was like to serve in France in World War I?
The book was actually quite popular at the time it was published. This book comes out in the context of a movement of African-American thought leaders, artists, and intellectuals pushing back against the racial standards of the early 20th century. We often refer to this movement as the New Negro. It's an outgrowth of the NAACP, African-American intellectual experience, and the crucible of the war experience. African Americans who came home from France, where they had fought either directly or indirectly for democracy, and where they had experienced among the French people a certain level of social equality, genuinely expected to receive equal treatment in the United States. And so in that year after World War I, 1919, we see an outbreak of hostility between African Americans who are fighting for their rights in the United States and the racialized, segregated white establishment in the United States. There are riots from Chicago to Texas. But this movement doesn't die away after 1919. It continues to gather momentum, and we see an increasing round of oppositionality between African-American leaders and segregation. And this leads, among other things, to the Harlem Renaissance, to a very influential anthology of literature called The New Negro, and an antagonistic paradigm between African-American writers and segregation.
My guest is Mercer University English professor David Davis. He has written a book about the African-American experience in World War I in literature, and we're learning about some of the things that the Black soldiers encountered going into World War I and coming away from it. Well, I want to pick up on that new Negro idea and also to thrive in France, a place outside of the U.S. This is something we know later in the Jazz Age. Artists and writers absolutely embraced in France. And likewise, soldiers. Eugène Jacques Boulard, he's from, actually, I suppose you wouldn't say his name quite so French, because he's from Columbus, Georgia. Eugène Jacques Boulard was the first African-American military pilot. French General Charles de Gaulle called him a true French hero, named him a knight of the French Legion of Honor. So how did the French treat Black soldiers during the war, both citizens and army, compared to how they were treated in the U.S.?
African-Americans who experienced social equality in France were forever changed by the experience. However, French treatment of African-American soldiers was highly problematic for the U.S. War Department. W.E.B. Du Bois collected a number of documents after the war, including a set of orders from the U.S. War Department to their French counterparts, explaining to them how to treat African-American soldiers. And it includes rules such as, do not look them in the eye, do not salute them, do not speak to them using their military title. So there was an attempt to segregate the experience of African-Americans among the French people. However, the French people were not much inclined to follow the U.S. government's regulations. So they tended to treat African-American soldiers in the same way they treated all other soldiers who were fighting for their freedom on French soil. So African-Americans in the war, they have relationships with French people on equitable terms. They're treated like humans, like men. And that, for people who had spent their entire lives in a system of dehumanizing segregation, was a revolutionary experience.
When soldiers returned, as you said, they'd seen another glimpse of the way that they could be treated. Some actively opposed and protested American-style racism on their return, and tensions really came to a head in the summer of 1919 in what was called the Red Summer. What happened?
So in the Red Summer, there were racial riots across the United States. One of the most famous occurred in Chicago, Illinois, when African-American swimmers made their way across an imaginary line dividing a white-only beach from a black-only beach. This leads to a violent riot that goes on for several days. Also during that summer, there was a racial massacre in Elaine, Arkansas. There are riots in D.C. There are riots in Texas. Altogether, there's about 25 race riots across the country. Now, racial violence in the United States this time is not unusual. In fact, we're talking about a period of time that is the heyday of racial lynchings. But what characterizes the Red Summer is we see in all of these riot instances, African Americans fighting back against white supremacy, sometimes fighting back with arms. And in many cases, we see African Americans who had returned from World War I fighting for their own rights in the United States.
The poet Claude McKay wrote a poem reflecting the increasingly defiant spirit of Black Americans. Can you give us a couple of lines from that poem, If We Must Die?
Yes, this is a famous poem that embodies the ethos of the New Negro. The poem reads, "If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back."
There is so much in that poem, the imagery of the soldier returned, and apparently, given that there were so many lynchings in the United States in that time, even African-Americans who'd been serving and were lynched in uniform. So what, given that, was the legacy for African-American soldiers who fought in World War I?
Mixed at best. To pick up on your example of African-Americans who were lynched in uniform, there's one story of a returning soldier named Wilbur Little who returns to Baxley, Georgia. And he's met at the train station while wearing his uniform and told by an angry white mob that if he wears the uniform again, he'll be killed. 2 weeks later, he appears in public in his uniform, and he's lynched while wearing his uniform. He was one of more than a dozen African-American veterans who were lynched after the war, in some cases literally while wearing their uniforms. The message for African-Americans about the war to make the world safe for democracy was mixed. On one hand, it makes the case that democracy, freedom, and equality are causes worth fighting for, in fact, worth dying for. But on the other hand, it makes clear the case that the United States is not going to be a nation that easily or quickly extends social equality to African Americans, that the lingering residue of racism and Jim Crow is going to cloud out immediate opportunities for social equality. I do argue, though, that this generation sets the foundation for what will eventually develop into the civil rights movement. It doesn't bring us quite to the point of nonviolent resistance. Instead, it brings us to the point of violent resistance. But it demonstrates that African Americans will fight, will die for their country and for their race.
David Davis, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Mercer University English professor David Davis. He is also author of the book World War I and Southern Modernism.